A Story of the Stone Age by H.G. Wells. This story is of a time beyond the memory of man, before the beginning of history, a time when one might have walked Drished from France, as we call it now, to England, and when a broad and sluggish Thames flowed through its marshes to meet its father Rhine, flowing through a wide and level country that is under water in these latter days, and which we know by the name of the North Sea. In that remote age, the valley which runs along the foot of the Downs did not exist, and the south of Surrey was a range of hills, fir-clad on the middle slopes, and snow-capped for the better part of the year. The cores of its summits still remain as Leith Hill, and Pitch Hill, and Hindhead. On the lower slopes of the range, below the grassy spaces where the wild horses grazed, were forests of yew and sweet chestnut and elm, and the thickets and dark places hid the grizzly bear and the hyena, and the gray apes clambered through the branches. And still lower amidst the woodland and marsh and open grass along the way did this little drama play itself out to the end that I have to tell. 50,000 years ago, it was 50,000 years, if the reckoning of geologists is correct. And in those days the springtime was as joyful as it is now, and sent the blood coursing in just the same fashion. The afternoon sky was blue with piled white clouds sailing through it, and the southwest wind came like a soft caress. The newcome swallows drove to and fro. The reaches of the river were spangled with white ranunculus. The marshy places were starred with lady smock and lit with marshmallow wherever the regiments of the sedges lowered their swords, and the northward moving hippopotami, shiny black monsters, sporting clumsily, came floundering and blundering through it all, rejoicing dimly and possessed with one clear idea, to splash the river muddy. Up the river, and well in sight of the hippopotami, a number of little buff-colored animals dabbled in the water. There was no fear, no rivalry, and no enmity between them and the hippopotami. As the great bulks came crashing through the reeds and smashed the mirror of the water into silvery splashes, these little creatures shouted and gesticulated with glee. It was the surest sign of high spring. Balu, they cried. Baya. Balu. They were the children of the men folk, the smoke of whose encampment rose from the knoll at the river's bend. Wild-eyed youngsters they were, with matted hair and little broad-nosed impish faces covered, as some children are covered even nowadays, with a delicate down of hair. They were narrow in the loins and long in the arms. And their ears had no lobes, and had little pointed tips, a thing that still, in rare instances, survives. Stark naked vivid little gypsies, as active as monkeys and as full of chatter, though a little wanting in words. Their elders were hidden from the wallowing hippopotami by the crest of the knoll. The human squatting place was a trampled area among the dead brown fronds of royal fern, through which the croziers of this year's growth were unrolling to the light and warmth. The fire was a smoldering heap of char, light gray and black, replenished by the old women from time to time with brown leaves. Most of the men were asleep. They slept sitting with their foreheads on their knees. They had killed that morning a good quarry, enough for all, a deer that had been wounded by hunting dogs, so that there had been no quarreling among them, and some of the women were still gnawing the bones that lay scattered about. Others were making a heap of leaves and sticks to feed Brother Fire when the darkness came again, that he might grow strong and tall therewith, and guard them against the beasts. And two were piling flints that they brought, an armful at a time, from the bend of the river where the children were at play. None of these buff-skinned savages were clothed, but some wore about their hips rude girdles of adderskin or crackling undressed hide, from which depended little bags, not made, but torn from the paws of beasts, and carrying the rudely dressed flints that were men's chief weapons and tools. And one woman, the maid of Wyah the Cunning Man, wore a wonderful necklace of perforated fossils that others had worn before her. Beside some of the sleeping men lay the big antlers of the elk, with the tines chipped to sharp edges and long sticks, hacked at the ends with flints into sharp points. There was little else save these things and the smoldering fire to mark these human beings off from the wild animals that ranged the country. But Wyah the Cunning did not sleep, but sat with a bone in his hand and scraped busily thereon with a flint, a thing no animal would do. He was the oldest man in the tribe, beetle-browed, prognathous, lank-armed. He had a beard and his cheeks were hairy, and his chest and arms were black with thick hair. And by virtue both of his strength and cunning he was master of the tribe, and his share was always the most and the best. Eudena had hidden herself among the alders, because she was afraid of Wyah. She was still a girl, and her eyes were bright, and her smile pleasant to see. He had given her a piece of the liver, a man's piece, and a wonderful treat for a girl to get. But as she took it, the other woman with the necklace had looked at her, an evil glance, and Ugh Lomi had made a noise in his throat. At that, Waya had looked at him long and steadfastly, and Ugh lomi's face had fallen. And then Waya had looked at her. She was frightened, and she had stolen away, while the feeding was still going on, and Waya was busy with the marrow of a bone. Afterwards he had wandered about, as if looking for her. And now she crouched among the alders, wondering mightily what Waya might be.